Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Telecommunications and Electronic Media and Free Speech Practice Groups, was recorded on Friday, January 26, 2018, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members.
Welcome to the Federal Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon's topic is the aftermath of restoring Internet freedom, lessons from foreign jurisdictions. My name is Wesley Hodges, and I'm the Associate Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today we are fortunate to have with us Professor Ellie Noem, who is the Paul Garrett Professor of Public Policy and Business Responsibility at the Columbia Business School. Also with us is Professor Rosalind Layton, who is a PhD Fellow for the Center for Communication, Media, and Information Studies at Aalborg University and visiting scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. Also with us is Mr. Beaudry, who is a lawyer and research associate at the Montreal Economic Institute. After our speakers give their remarks, we will open for an audience Q&A. So as they're speaking, please keep in mind any questions you might have for them. Thank you for speaking with us today. Professor Layton, the floor is yours to start.
Well, thank you so much, and thank you to my fellow panelists. I want to begin by first recognizing Federalist Society to take the opportunity to go into the international angles on the issues of net neutrality and internet freedom. If you go onto FedSoc's website, they have a number of discussions of this going into details of all the different legal issues in the United States. The various petitions of the Supreme Court, and you can spend, all the time that you want going into those areas. As I understand today, we are going to take a step back and look at net neutrality and internet freedom as we look around the world and some of the responses to activities in the United States. So, what I wanted to do here is to give you a review of the status of the various, the sort of comparative internet regulations in the key regions around the world, the European Union, Latin America, India, and as I hope I understand, our Canadian colleague will talk about the unique case of Canada, and I'm looking forward to remarks from Professor Noem, which also has an important and unique insight on this topic. So I think another important point here is when we talk about net neutrality and internet freedom, these are two different, very different concepts. And I think that you can ask many people who will give you different definitions, but I'm going to give you working definitions that I have. When we talk about net neutrality, it's sort of a notion of treating, all data is treated the same, but it has very important regulatory implications, which will entail, that consumers have to value all data the same, that in certain cases there will be restrictions on pricing flexibility, there'll be price controls, there will be certain requirements for how providers of internet access provide their services. And it can also be interpreted by some to mean, let's say it has a relationship to a government provision of broadband. Now, in the case of internet freedom, I think it's an important way to say it would be, permissionless innovation for internet technologies. It is a kind of concept where different broadband technologies should compete. The user can value content differently. The user can be able to decide whether they want to bundle content or not, how they want to pay for it, and so on. So these are, two competing visions of how we see the internet and how they play out in different countries. Maybe a blend of both. They may go in between a pendulum. But in any case, where we are in the United States today, as you all know, in December 2017, the FCC it repealed the 2015 Open Internet Order. It released a new order called Restoring Internet Freedom. That particular order maintains and strengthens the transparency provisions that the FCC adopted in 2015. Adopted back in 2012, excuse me. Those were used to challenge AT&T Mobility, so they are quite powerful. But it also, importantly, it restores the jurisdiction of the Federal Trade Commission to be able to police the broadband sector that had been removed with the 2015 rules. And so in any case, as you'll know, there's been a lot of backlash. A number of governors and state attorney general are now suing the FCC. They want to implement their own net neutrality rules. that's a whole other discussion about federalism and the Communications Act. But in any case, what's interesting now to look at, where does this leave a number, you know, now that the United States has made this reverse of Obama-era policy, what does this say going forward? Now, what I would say is we shouldn't see the reverse as a surprise. If you look at in 2016, the Republican Party laid out a platform for the voters prior to the election that they disapproved of the direction. They didn't like the internet regulation. They didn't believe it was fair. They preferred to go in a direction of legislation. So in many cases, it was known by everyone that the as a Republican FCC would pursue a restoration of the previous policy, which was the Federal Trade Commission had jurisdiction over broadband. So in any case, but many people have been outraged. You had European Union, parliamentarians, 150, which have tend to be on the left, made a note of how much they were unhappy with this, Canada and other countries. But what's interesting is that for most of the countries in the world that have net neutrality rules, they have done them through legislation. If you look at a country like Chile, the first country to have net neutrality rules, they had gone through a period where they were litigating the issue back and forth, and it finally took the Chilean Congress to make a law to stop the lawsuits. So where the U.S. finds itself today is not unlike a process that many countries have gone through to decide that telecom regulators, if they are to regulate the internet, they may need to specify that in the Communications Acts of the various countries. So that is actually what's happened in the European Union in 2015. The EU adopted rules, which they call for access to the internet. They don't say net neutrality, but they have to do with a set of traffic management and speed disclosure rules. So that was adopted there in the EU. What's interesting, however, is that the FCC, when going through its process in 2015, it, at least in the written record, doesn't appear to take into account what we've learned from a lot of other countries. So we know that Netherlands, Slovenia, a number of countries in Latin America predate the United States in terms of their experience with this issue. In the Nordic countries, they have been using codes of conduct and multi-stakeholder rules going back to 2009 with quite a lot of success. And when I say success, meaning that there continued to be investment in innovation, there were no complaints on record, and you know, you have flourishing broadband ecosystems. Similarly, in Japan and South Korea have also used soft methods. So those have been actually workable regimes that didn't require some kind of either legislation or regulation, but the FCC didn't take into account those instruments when it made its rules, or at least it wasn't in the record. We can look at Latin America, which going back to 2010 or so, a number of Latin American countries have implemented their own kinds of rules. You have Mexico has made it part of its constitution, various different approaches of some kind of legislation or some sort of a plan. For example, Colombia adopted a plan that comes with the presidency. But the interesting thing in Latin America is that the countries, the sort of they haven't reported new innovation. I mean, that, and they are to some degree, some sense of buyer's remorse from a lot of Latin American countries because they expected to have the next Google or that they'd have a flourishing of locally made apps. They haven't had that. And so there is a, by a number of countries, either to not enforce rules or to revisit them, to sort of say they, these, we were promised net neutrality was going to bring us the sweetness and light. It didn't happen. So we need to revisit this. Some countries are actually looking to move to the antitrust approach, a similar FTC approach that we have now in the United States. I think Brazil is an interesting case. The Marco Civil, which was heralded at the time it was passed, has now become, because of the tainting with the now how impeached president of Brazil, now the Marco Civil is many are kind of turning away from it because of the unfortunate incidents with their prior president. So in any case, we know even in the European Union, there are laws in place, and it's certainly the, if, you know, I would recommend if you want to make lasting laws, you need to do legislation. It's not perfect, but the Europeans would certainly say they believe their approach is superior because it's sustainable. But that being said, there are still issues of litigation. There's issues around interpretation, different regulators different countries have different interpretations. There's a number of lawsuits going on now about zero rating. So the moral of the story is, even when you make laws to clarify things, you know, sometimes they become more muddy. So there are pros and cons to any approach that you take. In the United States, if we look towards a legislative approach, you know, the downside, the plus side, maybe there would be less litigation, but a downside could be reduced First Amendment freedoms. I mean, our First Amendment is very clear that the government is not supposed to regulate speech, but net neutrality is a kind of a speech regulation, in that the government mandates that traffic has to be delivered or can't be blocked or so on. Those are speech regulations. So in any case, we certainly have a lot to learn by looking around the world. We have now a globally active world on this issue. And my last point here, and I'll be happy to wrap up my remarks. I think the other thing that we have observed is that this is now a global issue. So you may be a regulator in the United States, but you will now, when you conduct a public comment, you will get millions of commenters from around the world who will want to influence the outcome of your policymaking. Now, for better or worse, that could be, maybe you welcome that, but it might also raise, administrative law concerns around, you know, whom is the telecom regulator accountable to? How does it track or report upon those comments? In the European Union, one third of the comments to its proceeding were made by people from the United States. So what does that say about the European Commission and the body of European regulators who claim to be accountable to European citizens? So now we have a number of, you might say, exciting, interesting developments, but it also raises questions to the classic kind of questions around separation of powers and administrative law. So I hope that that gets people thinking, and we'll take our discussion through the next steps.
Shall I begin to address?
Please do.
This is Ellie Noam, and my observations are the following after this very, very comprehensive analysis that we just heard about around the world survey, is that what we're observing here is the coming to a fore, the internal contradiction, if I may say, of the net neutrality debate, where the same people will hold two conflicting views frequently. So that you have the position of people who say the internet has to be free and uncensored and viewpoint neutral, and there cannot be any distinctions based on content or on the speaker. That's the one position. And the same people will also say, yes, but there's also some kind of content and some kind of speech, whether it is hateful or otherwise, that we have to control. And the question, of course, is who will control it? So you have, on the one hand, no control, and on the other hand, controls. And that is a contradiction that is becoming clearer now, as we also observe different governments around the world instituting rules applying to the internet, or often applying the rules that already exist, extending it to the internet. For example, each country has its own tradition and history, leading it to have certain content rules. For example, in Thailand, you cannot say anything derogatory about the royal family. In Germany, there are some restrictions about the glorification of the Third Reich and various content associated with it. In France, you have different rules. In Sweden, you have different rules. Each country, Saudi Arabia for short. So each country has its own rules, and they could coexist in some vague way in the past because we were not kind of on top of each other. But now the internet makes it global. And the question then is, how do we coordinate this? Because it is, after all, if one believes in state rights and the ability of sovereign countries and jurisdictions to have their own rules, whether they're foolish rules or smart rules is another question. But certainly there is the sovereignty right to have rules. And then the question is, how do you make it happen on a globally prevalent networks as the internet is? And so inevitably, then you would have the extension of these rules to some intermediary, and that could be the network provider or the ISP, that is, or the content provider platforms, the kind of the Googles, the Facebooks of this world. Now, the logic that I see is that the regulation will be extended, the policing of these kind of national content or neutrality rules will be given to not so much to the content providers, because they are everywhere and in other jurisdictions, offshore, sometimes anonymous. But instead, that those policing obligations will be given to that part of the value chain, of the communications chain, that is clearly under national jurisdiction. That is the transmission part, the telephone, the mobile type parts, that, in other words, the ISP parts. And so therefore the ISPs actually will end up being tasked with some kind of policing of content that is deemed to be undesirable for a particular national jurisdiction, of reaching the citizens or being sent out by citizens of that particular jurisdiction. And that is totally in contradiction to the whole net neutrality basic concept. It is in effect making the network provider, the ISP, a responsible party in being non-neutral. And so we're going to see very soon, as people start to kind of get upset about Google and Facebook, as Europeans do, sometimes for reasons that are really protectionist in nature, that's often will not be admitted, but basically is kind of a big American company, it's kind of a relatively popular thing to mandate rules and restrictions and kind of cloak them into some form of a European flag. We will see a continuation of that trend, and that the national communications providers will be at the forefront of that obligation.
Thank you, Professor. Mr. Beaudry, would you like to begin?
Sure. Well, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be discussing the controversial issue of net neutrality with the Federalist Society. I'm here to provide a bit of an overview of how the issue has been dealt with in Canada. And one thing that I've noticed since the debate has exploded in the United States after Chairman Pai's announcement in November was that the issue of net neutrality in Canada has never really been a big issue from a political perspective. I don't think I've ever seen the word net neutrality used in a political party's electoral platform. It's never really been discussed, and there's really never been public debates amongst elected officials around that concept until November, when a few Canadian pundits started writing about what was going on in the United States. And needless to say, the issue was quite controversial. And one member of parliament from the Conservative Party voiced support for what was going on in the United States. And quite frankly, that politician got lambasted by both sides of the aisle in the Canadian political world. So generally, net neutrality in Canada is a bit like apple pie. There's, you know, people can't think of any reason why they should oppose it. It's interesting to see how net neutrality has developed in Canada. There's no explicit mention of net neutrality in our telecom legislation. So in Canada, we have the general legislation that governs the telecom sectors, the Telecommunications Act, which was enacted in 1993. And despite the fact that there is no express mentions of net neutrality, in a way, there are certain provisions in the Act that to a certain extent do enshrine these principles in legislation. So essentially, the Telecom Act in particular provides that a telecom carrier cannot give undue or unreasonable preference, for example, to one application or an online service over another, nor can these carriers influence the content being transmitted over their networks. So these provisions in particular have served as the basis for several CRTC decisions that have essentially protected what most people would think as core net neutrality principles. Most recently, over the past few years, I would say that the prime casualty of this rigid interpretation of these principles have been zero rating plans that have been promoted by Canadian carriers. And, you know, when I've been looking at the history of zero rating plans in the United States, what I found to be very interesting is that very often they've been used by smaller players in the market in an attempt, obviously, to gain market share and to gain a wider customer base. And in Canada, you've had a bit of a similar situation. The last decision by the CRTC that touched upon net neutrality was a decision that essentially sanctioned a regional player, a Quebec regional player called Vidéotron, which essentially offered an unlimited music service whereby certain music applications, which were not owned by the carrier, were not included, or actually consumers who would use these applications would not see their data counted as part of their data cap. And the CRTC clamped down on Vidéotron, essentially claiming that by providing this zero-rated service, Vidéotron was going against the spirit of net neutrality and providing an undue preference to certain applications over others. It's been interesting to see this because people were saying before there's a difference between enshrining the principles of net neutrality in legislation versus taking a softer approach. And Canada is currently in the midst of reviewing its telecom legislation. And despite the fact that net neutrality has been protected quite robustly by our regulator, some activists are activating currently in the hopes that the next iteration of the legislation will contain an explicit mention of net neutrality and how it should be protected. Another aspect I find quite interesting is the debate about what utility regulation means, because I think that Title II regulation meant much more than net neutrality, however you would define the concept. And what I noticed was that in Canada, internet services or broadband services are treated as utilities. And what we've seen in Canada is, despite the fact that we have a pretty robust broadband ecosystem, the regulator over the past few years has taken certain decisions that I think will have a deleterious impact on the broadband environment and will ultimately reduce investment and innovation. And the prime decision I have in mind is a 2015 decision by the regulator that essentially mandates the unbundling of next generation fiber networks to resellers. And this is a debate that's been going on in Canada for a while. And when I compare this to what's been going on in the United States, where essentially since I believe the early 2000s, there's been a handoff approach on mandatory unbundling and the regulator has abstained from mandating it. In Canada, we've taken a different route. And over the years, it's gone from mandating access to legacy networks to mandating access to next generation networks that haven't even been built yet. So the reason I'm mentioning this is that one of the fears expressed by certain stakeholders in the Title II debate in the United States was that Title II could lead to additional economic type regulation and potentially mandatory unbundling. And these types of policies have been extremely deleterious to some European countries. Canada hasn't gone to that length in imposing such drastic policies. However, what we've seen in the past couple of years is an increased appetite on the part of the regulator to stimulate the resale market. And I think that this will have a serious negative impact on Canada's broadband market. And I can understand the fears there are on the U.S. side that all-encompassing ex-ante regulation could bring about negative consequences for the U.S. broadband ecosystem. I would like to conclude by saying that one thing I find particularly telling is that there's some people have been very quick to pit the net neutrality debate as being a debate between David and Goliath. So you have the big ISPs and you have the small consumers or the small businesses. When I feel like this is much more complex than this, and especially when you look at some of the parties and stakeholders who have been expressing themselves as part of this debate, I think that some of the companies that have been the most vocal about this in the United States are the smaller companies, the smaller broadband companies, who don't have huge regulatory departments like their bigger brethren, and who really fear that this uncertainty could really bring about lower investments and much more uncertainty in the way they conduct their business. And I see that something could be, that there's a bit of a similar debate in Canada. However, I think in a way in Canada, because we've been so prone to favor reseller policies over the past few decades, we have a lesser amount of facilities-based providers, especially regional players. So I think that's one of the other components that I would keep in mind when looking at these vast regulatory schemes. I would tend to prefer ex post regimes where regulators look at types of behaviors that might be in a certain circumstance abusive or overly dominant and sanction them on a particular basis, as opposed to banning certain practices ex ante and potentially having unseen consequences in the future. So that, in a nutshell, this is what I have to say.
Yeah, so I want to thank both the panelists for two sets of very stimulating remarks and actually very important points. First, to Professor Noem, he's absolutely right about this issue of intermediary liability. This was something brought up as what many have called the copyright loophole was coined. I can't recall if it's Electronic Frontier Foundation or whomever, but in any case, there have been these debates that a number of countries have laws that say, you know, only legal content can be blocked, right? Can't be blocked, for example. So that means that it's a de facto copyright regime that, you know, certain content that hasn't been copyrighted for that region can legally be blocked. So I think that Ellie is touching on something that we are seeing with a number of activists around the world who are concerned for their particular country, that it becomes a kind of censorship regime that the government is forcing the ISP to do. But I would take it a step further, because I don't think that it's only the ISP that's being forced in this position. The regulator, when we look at the European Union, the European Union's rules, their net neutrality rules, have a set of what's called transparency requirements, which they define as speed disclosures. So for them, they have an extremely detailed set of compliance about how an ISP must disclose to the customer what speed is promised, what is the minimum expected, maximum, average for 24 hours. There's a whole set of things. And so presently, the body of European regulators for electronic communications is trying to set up some kind of a measurement tool that would essentially run all the time, so that now regulators themselves will monitor the networks to make sure that they're behaving in this, quote, neutral way to achieve certain kinds of speeds. Now, you can say, well, it's great that they do their job, but the downside of this is that it may, in fact, violate the privacy rules of the European Union, which have very strict controls around, you know, the government looking in or monitoring the networks. So there again, I think what Professor brought up so well is there's this conflict going on the one hand, trying to achieve whatever the stated social goal may be, neutrality, if you will. But then in order to achieve that, it has to bring in this other concern, which is surveillance to ensure that these operators are behaving in the right way. So that's an emerging issue that we've seen in Latin America and European Union. The next point I wanted to make, I think, is very important from countries not being the United States, but for example, France, many countries, and could be Canada, they may perceive that they are being overrun by American content providers, the GAFA, the, you know, Google, Amazon, Facebook, Apple, FANG, you've heard all these names, Netflix and so on. And, you know, from their perspective, they say, well, look, we built these networks. They are being, you know, 80 to 99% of the traffic is coming from another country. They don't pay to help us to pay for these networks. This is a raw deal for us. So the regulators actually see net neutrality as their door to regulate the, to do platform regulation. So as part of the French approach to this, they have developed what they call a platform approach, which has an associated set of components, platform transparency, platform audibility, social impact, what is the impact of the platform on society, and a ability to rate the reputation of the platform. So France is just one example of a country that is using the premise of net neutrality, regulate the ISPs, as their means to regulate the whole ecosystem. And this is not something that they are, it's not anything they're hiding. They've been extremely upfront about this is the internet is an ecosystem, the ISP is just the door to the whole thing, and that's where they want to go. Now, we've also heard this sort of discussion in the United States to leading Democrat senators. They've talked about, you know, Al Franken, Elizabeth Warren. They have also indicated this idea net neutrality has to apply to everything, not just the ISP. We need to bring it on to, it's going to help us regulate Google for fake news or Facebook for fake news. So this is that many of us who've been concerned about this, we predicted that, you know, this is just the door opener. We're going to use it. This will be used to regulate the rest of the ecosystem. And, you know, you could see some of those things happening.
Yeah, this is Ellie. If I can say I briefly, I quite agree. I think it's kind of the foot in the door here. And in fact, you can quite imagine that the non-neutrality will be applied based on those regulatory powers. For example, zero rating. It's just a matter of minutes, if it hasn't already been done, that there would be some national preferences given. For example, Europeans and French in the lead are for national quotas or European quotas. And zero rating gives you a kind of a regulatory way to do that by differentiating between imported American content from, say, European or French content. One can be zero rated or partly zero rated, and the other can not so.
Canada has also a protectionist cultural broadcasting whereby we have, you know, selected, we have a, first of all the broadcasters need to contribute to a fund that is used to produce Canadian content. And one of the big scandals going on right now is that the outside platforms such as Netflix don't have to pay into that fund. So needless to say, our broadcasters feel that there's a free rider issue here. And recently, the Canadian government struck a deal with Netflix whereby Netflix would agree to spend a certain amount, I think it was $250 million in Canadian content over the coming years. But yet the broadcasters are still not happy about this because they feel like they should have been able to extract full contribution of Netflix to the Canadian media fund. And I find this quite interesting because when you have protectionist cultural policies such as that one, and it's, you know, not particularly surprising, I come from a French part of Canada, so we don't really feel under siege by the Canadian content, and Quebecers consume a great amount of French content. However, English Canadians feel differently. However, the fact that the CRTC has banned these zero rating practices is a bit ironic because it could have been a great cultural tool to promote this protected Canadian content.
There's a point I want to make. I'm not sure if it can come off so eloquently or not, but I'm going to give it a try. You know, so from the user perspective, I think you'll frequently hear an argument from net neutrality advocates, you know, all content is equal. I want to pay one price and access everything. And, you know, that actually can sound quite consumerist on the one hand, that sounds like the right way to go. But when you hear the international, if you look at it from an international perspective, it's also helpful to understand, you know, let's say you can certainly look at French, English, Anglophone Canada, French-speaking Canada. Let's say, for example, you know, you live in the Netherlands where, you know, 90% of the networks, they use a lot of Netflix content. Well, a lot of the films are Harvey Weinstein company, for example. Perhaps you're not too happy with this company or its former chairman, and you really don't want to watch those movies. But you don't have the ability as an end user to say, I don't want my subscription to provision that kind of content. I'm against it for personal reasons, religious reasons, any other. It's not my choice. It's my language, what have you. So these are real concerns that people have, and that may, in some ways, you know, the critique from, let's say, a free market perspective is we're forcing consumers to make a judgment about that they can't value, they have to value offensive content the same as content that they do value or what have you. And I think that Ellie raises a very good point about this idea about neutrality could actually be used to, you get the opposite thing. So then you'll say, well, I'm in XYZ country. I'm only going to, you know, all of this has to be charged at this rate and all the rest is not. So in any case, it's a sort of it's a conundrum around who gets to choose. The one other issue it's important to point out, which has related to the issue around who is the provider, and we've talked about mandated access and reselling and the different policies the countries use. What was important about the 2015 decision to use Title II was that particular instrument has a taxation capability such that the FCC could levy a tax onto private broadband provision and earn a source of revenue that the FCC could use to support, for example, municipal broadband. And that in fact was a revenue earner that could be used to support alternative networks. And in many cases, you know, for many advocates, that is the goal. They want to be able to achieve a government provision of broadband because they don't like the private provision or for whatever reason. Now, there's arguments for and against that, but there is a sort of, if we're going back to the public broadcasting model, there were reasons why different countries, for better or worse, said, well, there's only going to be two TV stations, and we're going to make, there will be a national broadcast station because this is the only way it can be neutral and fair and objective. Well, you know, you end up with less content. But the argument on the internet freedom side is that the technologies itself should compete. So when the European Union comes with a speed requirement, what they're trying to do is to force the European operators to get off their DSL copper plants and upgrade to fiber because the reselling model didn't work in Europe, European Union, that you still have the same incumbents, the former state-owned incumbents have most of the net market share. They, in spite of all the reselling model, it didn't work. So they're trying now through what they call transparency and net neutrality, forcing companies to keep increasing the speeds that they will, through this requirement, upgrade their networks to fiber. When we come back to the question of internet freedom, the question there is fiber to the home the best way to do it? Now, if we're coming to 5G, where you can get the same throughput through the air, but through a different technology, you can still get it, but you get it a different way, and it's done through different means. So at the issue here is, how do we, you know, who decides what kind of technology we use? Is it a government mandate for a fiber to the home with municipal networks? Or is the marketplace going to drive innovations through 5G or different technologies or the interplay thereof, fixed Wi-Fi or what have you? So I'm not trying to say this is black or white because we have different degrees of this in every country, but it is important to see that there is a fundamental debate whether there's a central planning of the internet or to what degree different technologies can be allowed to be tried, and consumers themselves can also exert how they want to consume them, and then to what extent these big content companies will also pay for the use of the network. To what degree are they responsible to pay for the networks? Is all the cost to be borne by the end user?
Wonderful. Thank you so much for those remarks. Would any of our speakers have anything to say before we move to audience Q&A?
I think we should move to audience.
Let's turn to our first caller.
This is Arielle Roth, member of the Federal Society's Telecom and Electronic Media Practice Group Executive Committee. Thank you to all of the participants for their contributions on this call. It's been very fascinating. I was just wondering if the participants could discuss, given the disparate approaches between the U.S. and Europe and U.S. and Canada to mandatory unbundling, as well as net neutrality, can we expect differences in the in broadband deployment in the future among various jurisdictions discussed, particularly in the area of 5G deployment?
So we know, well, United States, Verizon's going to want five cities this here in 2018 will be will feature a 5G test. They're going to deploy that this year. There is a track in Japan and South Korea already for 5G, China as well. So AT&T is not far behind Verizon in doing this. What unfortunately is the case is European Union is not on track, and they have the European Commission's admitted this. This is something of an embarrassment for them because they felt because they were first with 3G, for example. That was the important thing where they all got everybody to go to the European GSM standard. That was when the Europeans beat the U.S. They came out with GSM, and that was, hey, too bad for your CDMA. We're going to move to the GSM, and Apple stopped making CDMA phones. So that was what the Europeans were sort of banking on because they had the biggest telecom companies, and they were going to be the winners. Well, you know, then the United States says, well, hey, we're not doing that. Verizon said we're going to 4G and now to 5G. So this is kind of, I think, going to be an important debate around the European and U.S. approach. And certainly we're going to be watching this year how quickly that 5G comes online. I mean, an argument, let's say, for the ISPs was that net neutrality is difficult for us if we want to do 5G because the 5G network model is inherently anti-neutral. I mean, it's a smart network. It prioritizes content. It's totally designed to be giving different quality of service for different kinds of applications. So you can get less than best efforts, more than best efforts. You have every grade and shade of things depending upon the most efficient use. You know, hundreds of devices in your home, they're not all treated the same, and you don't want your heart monitor to have the same treatment as the fridge, for example. So that was, I think, a concern from an industry side that net neutrality is a bomb in the 5G future. We have now a period of time to explore how it actually plays out. I think it's interesting to look at East Asia. They have been very soft, if almost nothing at all, around net neutrality. I mean, and I think from their perspective, from video game makers in South Korea, where they're making games that require prioritization for games to work and so on, they really would be concerned about adopting rules that would imperil their game makers to use the network's capabilities. So I think it's quite telling that the Japan, South Korea, and China, certainly leaders in networks, have been extremely soft on net neutrality, if almost nothing at all.
I just wanted to make a short mention of what I've already mentioned about Canada. We have a history of mandating the unbundling of last mile networks to resellers. And I think that the regulator over the years has given too much importance to these policies by thinking that they were the key to have a strong competitive broadband sector in the country. And Canada has had a robust broadband market, and we have some of the best networks in the world. But that's due to the competition that we have between our incumbents and the cable companies. I mean, it's facilities-based competition that has allowed Canada to become one of the a broadband leader. And as I was mentioning before, in 2015, the government mandated the unbundling of fiber to the home networks. And kind of the first time the government ever mandates the unbundling of networks that were not even built yet. They were still in the process of being built, and they still are in the process of being built. So we are expecting that, you know, this won't necessarily have an impact in the big urban centers. However, Canada is an extremely big country, and there's a lot of rural and remote communities that are hoping to get these types of high-quality, high-speed networks. And a decision like the decision that the CRTC made on fiber-to-the-home networks will certainly have a negative impact at the margin. and essentially prevents some communities in the country from getting these networks because it just won't make sense from an economics perspective to deploy the networks in certain areas where, you know, once you build the networks, you have to share them with your competitors at a regulated rate, and there's a very small potential customer base that will ultimately hurt a lot of Canadians who don't live in the global and urban centers.
Let me add, although some of it has now been discussed, which is that there's a fundamental difference of countries that have a robust cable network, which includes the United States, Canada, some of the smaller European countries, Benelux, but also Germany, but not including, for example, Italy and Japan. And in those countries where you have a strong cable infrastructure, the competitive forces have required the telecom network providers also to upgrade more aggressively in order to keep up. And that where in contrast, in countries where you have basically only the telecom infrastructure, there the unbundling requirements, in fact, gave a disincentive to create alternative networks because you could ride relatively convenient terms on the existing infrastructure. So you have a less competitive market, and that leads, therefore, to greater possibly incentives for others to come in with 5G. It would not surprise me if after all is said and done that there would be more of a open market or more of an opportunity for 5G providers, not being the incumbent telecom providers, in countries where there is no strong cable infrastructure already as an alternative.
Thank you, caller, for your question. It looks like there are no other questions in the queue. If you'd like to ask a question before we end the call today, just enter the star key and then the pound key on your telephone.
If we don't have any questions, I can make a few more comments, but I will defer to any questions that's in the queue.
Looks like there are no questions currently in the queue, so Professor Noam, please go ahead.
I think one of the things that we observe here is that the forces that were unleashed by some of the companies that were advocating net neutrality are going to come and bite them significantly, because all the arguments about neutrality and market power, et cetera, are going to be turned against them to almost with the identical arguments and analyses. So yesterday, perhaps the ISP were in the driver's seat. There were only a few of them, and they were powerful. But now the tide is turning, and it is actually those FANGs or GAFAMs that are becoming increasingly part of public attention and activism and regulatory scrutiny. And once you have established that there are certain public utility-type applications to the Internet, it's going to be very hard to differentiate that from Google itself. And Google has been at the forefront a while ago of advocacy for net neutrality. It's going to be very hard to differentiate these and now what you're observing, though, is that whereas for ISPs, because they are relatively territorial, you could have national regulators dealing with their net neutrality type principles on ISPs within their jurisdictions. But when it comes to the content providers and the platforms, the cloud providers, that is a much more a supranational, international type activity where the regulatory activities of one country are going to inevitably spill across their borders to the rest of the world. And we will see soon advocacy of something that can be called cloud neutrality that will affect those providers of content and of cloud services in a fairly significant way. And it is the sorcerer's apprentice in some ways scenario here. The forces that some companies have unleashed are going to come and run back to bite them.
Thank you, Professor. Do any of our other speakers have any comments they would like to make?
I would just say that I would tend to agree with what Professor Noam said about trend of neutrality expanding much on a much wider scale than what it was originally meant to cover. And I find it very interesting that some of the companies that were the initial cheerleaders for these types of policies might realize that it was a bit of a Pandora's box to start lobbying about net neutrality. And especially nowadays where we have these big content platforms increasingly appearing to be in the bullseye of antitrust regulators across the world, I think they may come to regret their appetite for more stringent regulation of ISPs and the ultimate impact that it will have on their own businesses.
There was a time when the internet community was fairly staunchly libertarian, and it could make that as a principled argument. But once it became advocating a regulation of parts of it, it kind of lost its libertarian, then it became a regulate the other guy but not me, so it became a very selective libertarianism, and that loses a lot of its credibility.
So I want to add one other point here from the regulator's perspective, and to thank my two panelists for, you know, just scintillating remarks. Extremely interesting for me to join you. That what's interesting as a regulator, I'm going to think of my colleague Brent Scorup at George Mason University. He's written very well on this, is that there is there's a regulator and is either responding to or being involved in these public discussions, and how does it recast what their role is? So in some, and there's a fundamental debate we have in the Federalist Society, is your role defined by the statute? Right? With what we go back to this whole debate about Title II, the internet, the telecom access, the internet should be free and unfettered. Well, you know, but then that's interpreted, well, we need to regulate the internet. So there is also a question for what is the regulator's role here? And then it becomes incumbent on, does the legislative branch need to weigh in to define what that role is, or to what degree is it self-defining for the regulator? How do they see it? And then there's a role in activism, as we've discussed. This isn't going away. I mean, you know, it's long been predicted this will be our long-term debate, but it is absolutely true. You know, this whole platform neutrality, cloud neutrality, that is now, you can just add whatever noun you want and it all will be neutral. But what that means is the regulator gets to decide. So, I hope we can come back again in a year and discuss how it's going.
On behalf of the Federal Society, I'd like to thank our speakers for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We welcome all listener feedback by email and info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us today. This call is now adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this practice group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.